All right, a wise man once told me to record all of my sermons, so I do. But even for the Sunday school, there's some that don't get to come, and they like to hear it on the internet. So, 1 Samuel, and I'm going to have you turn to chapter number 8. 1 Samuel chapter number 8. For those that are just joining us this morning, and those that may not be here all the time, let me just give you a reminder of what we're doing for Sunday school. We're going through the Bible book by book. I'm just giving you an overview, just a survey of the book. And I have to warn you that the next several books are very heavy. Yes. Okay, there are a lot of details in these next several books. And again, if I labored over all the details and tried to get through all of the things, we would never get through the book.
Right.
I do remember having a pastor one time preached through the book of 2 Peter. 2 Peter is not that large of a book.
Right.
Yet it took him 4 years to go through the entire book, okay? Because the Bible is a gold mine.
Right.
All right? And it's like a really good piece of chicken, okay? You eat on it and you eat on it and there's always just a little bit something there and you gnaw on it a little more and eventually you just have to say, I've gotten everything I can, but then there's more. There's always more. You never run out. It's a living book.
Amen.
It's not like any other book. Any other book, you read through it once or twice and you just kind of, you got everything that you know and you don't really need to pick it up anymore. But with the Bible, you get something new every time that you open it. And so we're in the book of 1 Samuel. Again, just doing a survey of the books of the Bible. We went over the book of Ruth last week. And boy, I loved that story. And what are you going to do with that old shoe, isn't it? And so that was just a great book talking about the kinsman redeemer. We see a type of Christ in that. And it was a blessing for me. We're in the books of history now. And so because they're books of history, there's lots of stories going on. And so the book of 1 Samuel, I should go ahead and tell you, there's 1 Samuel and 2 Samuel. In the original Hebrew Bible, this is one book. 1 and 2 Samuel is one volume. But for our sakes, it is split up into two separate books for easier reference. Okay, because understand, if it was one large book, that would be a lot. It would be a lot for you to look through, but 1 and 2 Samuel are kind of broken up. 1 Samuel focuses a lot on the early history of Israel and their monarchy. And then also the first king, Saul, and we'll get a little bit into David, but David is really going to star a lot in the book of 2 Samuel. So you can see this a lot in not just the books of Samuel, but the books of Kings and Chronicles. Again, originally one large book, but now subdivided into two separate books. So the purpose of the book of 1 Samuel, why was it written? Anytime we open up the Bible, we ought to ask ourselves, why was this written? And it was to record the life of Samuel, Israel's final judge. If you remember from the book of Judges, there was no king in Israel. Every man did that which was right in his own eyes. And we saw in the book of Judges how that is just a vicious cycle of failure and just incompetence when it comes to God's word, people just rejecting God. And I'd love to say that people just quit rejecting God, but that doesn't happen.
Right.
In fact, we see it kind of culminate in the book of 1 Samuel, the result of just a nation that has absolutely turned their whole backs on God, doesn't want anything to do with them. And it's sad, the results. We also see, we're recording the life of Samuel. He kind of acts as Israel's final judge. It also has his name on it. So it's also to record Israel's transition from a theocracy to a monarchy. Now, theocracy, you kind of see in there that root word, meaning a government or rule. But you see theo, which is Latin for God.
Right.
And so you can see from that where that means a rule by God. And up until this point, Israel had been ruled by God. God was their king. God was the one that was making the ordinances and the laws. God was the one that was carrying out these things. And now we are transitioning from a theocracy to a monarchy. Now Israel wants and demands a king, a human king. This also, the purpose of this book is to record the reign and rule of Saul, Israel's first king. And here's just a spoiler. He was not a great king.
Right.
He had a good beginning. He had a humble beginning. But somewhere along the lines, he lost that humility that kind of set him apart, if you would. And he let the power go to his head, and he, like everybody else, turned his back on God. And as the ruler and as the leader of Israel, when you have turned your back on God and you are encouraging others to do so,
right,
that's a dangerous position to be in.
Absolutely.
Finally, in this book, we see the preparation of David, Israel's greatest king so far. He will not be the greatest king there ever was,
right,
because that will be Jesus Christ.
Right.
But up until this point, Israel's greatest king, David, and we see the preparation of David and how he prepares for that. So who's the author of 1 Samuel? I'll give you three guesses, and the first two don't count. It's Samuel. Most likely Samuel. There may also be writings from prophets Nathan and Gad in here. We see some overlap in 1 Chronicles. It's written to the people of Israel, once again, trying to give them their history. And it also takes place in the day of the judges. Okay, so here's our key verse. This is the verse that that we're going to kind of encapsulate the whole book of 1 Samuel. We're in 1 Samuel chapter 8. And look at verse 7. And the Lord said unto Samuel, hearken unto the voice of the people in all that they say unto thee, for they have not rejected thee, but they have rejected me, that I should not reign over them. Now skip down to verse 9. Now therefore hearken unto their voice, howbeit yet protest solemnly unto them, and show them the manner of the king that shall reign over them. So here's the whole key verse of the book. God tells Samuel, listen, the people have not rejected you. Do not take their rebellion and their stubbornness personally.
Right.
Understand, this is not towards you in any way. This is to me. They've rebelled and they have rejected me. And so I'm going to give them what they want. You know, God is so good. And sometimes God is so good that he will give you exactly what you want, even if it's a detriment to you. And I think that's kind of where God was going here. The people wanted a king so badly that finally God said, fine, have it your way. But understand, when you get what you want, you better be careful what you wish for. Because it may end up being something you never really wanted in the first place.
Yes,
so you better be careful with those sorts of things. So what are the themes of the book of 1 Samuel? Obviously, the king. That's a big theme here. We also see God's control. You see, while the king is leading Israel, oftentimes God is the one that has to bring things back to order. He's the one that kind of has to rein things in because man is incapable of that sort of thing.
Right.
We also see leadership, what leaders ought to be and what leaders shouldn't be. Unfortunately, with the first king, Saul, we see a lot of what a leader should not be. We also see obedience. Obedience is a huge theme in the book of 1 Samuel. The blessings of what happens when you obey the Lord, and what happens when you don't obey the Lord. Rebellion. And later we'll see that God takes rebellion very seriously. I don't want to give too much away right now, but understand rebellion is a serious affront to God. And even through all of this, we see another theme, and we see God's faithfulness. Even though his people have completely turned their back on him, said, I don't want anything to do with God, and they've just turned him away, God is still faithful. God, throughout the entire Bible, God has been faithful to his people. God still has a plan for his chosen people. And we see God keeps his promises. So let's dive into the book of 1 Samuel. It starts with the birth of Samuel. Now, we see a woman named Hannah, and that's a special name for me because that's the name of my wife. Hannah is childless. She is one of two wives, and the other wife to this husband has children, and she does not. Now, understand, back in Bible times, I understand there's a lot of different issues that face women today, different health issues and things like that. Back in Bible times, that was considered a curse. That was considered a detriment to a woman, to not be able to have any children. That was definitely looked down upon. And so you have these two wives, which, by the way, is never a good idea. And people will say, well, where does God speak against polygamy in the Bible? He speaks against polygamy in every story of a man that takes more than one wife.
Right.
And that is the warning. In fact, God kind of says, I don't need to tell you not to do it because it should be pretty clear why it's a bad idea.
Yeah.
You know, there are some things that are just that are just implied, you know, and that's one of those things. Well, we see the wife that had the children, she was kind of lording it over Hannah, and Hannah just so desperately wanted a child, and so she prays as we ought to. When something is in our heart and there's a burden in our lives, something that's really getting on our back, we ought to be willing to take that burden to the Lord. And Hannah prays to the Lord, and she prays specifically for a son. And she says, and if you give me a son, I am going to give him back to you. And understand, that's a promise.
Yeah.
Understand, when you make that sort of a deal with God, God takes those things very seriously.
Yes, sir.
You better be willing to act on that sort of thing. And so, sure enough, Hannah conceives. And the baby is born, Samuel, for whom the book is named. And Samuel is the last judge. And when he's weaned, when he is kind of age, Hannah brings him to the temple, and she keeps up her promise. And she says, Lord, this child is yours. This is your child. I had the privilege of being his mother and raising him for this short time, but he is wholly dedicated to you. And that was to be Samuel's lot in life. He was going to be completely dedicated to the Lord. And so Hannah fulfills her promise to God, and Samuel serves the Lord under Eli. Eli's a priest in the temple. And now Eli has a problem, not really with himself, but with his sons. Eli has two sons, Hophni and Phinehas, and they have a reputation, and it's not a good reputation.
Right.
They have a reputation for extortion and all sorts of promiscuity in the temple. They have just made blasphemy of God's name. They have just taken God's name and just rubbed it in the dirt. And just, they've made a mockery of the worship. People don't even really want to go to offer their sacrifices and worship because they know Hophni and Phinehas and what they are known for. And don't think that Eli is innocent. Even though he himself is not taking place in their debauchery, Eli lets it happen.
Yeah.
We see that Eli had full knowledge of what was happening, and he did not want to deal with it. Can I just take a moment and say that you do a lot more harm than good by just ignoring the issue?
Yes, sir.
Just trying to sweep it under the rug, just trying to pretend it will go away. You know, sometimes you've got to rip things off.
Yeah.
like a bandage. And Eli's problem here was these were his sons. And if he reproved his sons, and I've seen this a lot. I used to be a youth pastor before being the pastor here. And I know what it was like because I saw a lot of parents who knew full and well the kind of wickedness that their teenagers were in. And they wanted me to handle it. Yeah. Okay? The preacher is not your go-to to handle all your problems.
Right.
Okay? You got to handle your own issues. Okay? I'll tell you a true story. I had a couple who had a son, and they were upset with who their son was dating. Now, I never really was big into the whole idea of dating anyway. And I told them that. And they said, well, this is what we want. We want you to talk to him and tell him that this is a bad idea and we don't want him dating this girl. And so for a while, I did. I tried to counsel him. I tried to say, hey, I don't think this is a good idea. Your parents are not happy with this. And he said, what do you mean? My parents are all for it. Come to find out, they wanted me to break him up. While they, in turn, said, I don't know what Brother Jesse's problem is. We're fine with it. They actually took him and his girlfriend out for his birthday, out to a restaurant. Can you believe that? This is real, okay? People are really like this. Okay? I know none of us are like that, right? None of us here at Bible Baptist Church. But people are just ridiculous like that. They'll say one thing and they'll turn around and do another. It's craziness. But Eli's problem here is he knew full well what his sons were involved with and what they were doing, and he just let it happen. And so Eli is very much as culpable as his sons. Understand at this time, the Bible says there was no open vision. Now, what that means is God was not communicating with his people like he had in times past. For the longest time, God had been pretty silent. You ever been there where you just feel like God hasn't spoken to you in a long while? Well, listen up, because that's when God wants to talk to you. Then we see that God calls Samuel while he's still a child. While he's still a child, God speaks to Samuel, not Eli. And keep in mind, Eli is a very highly respected elderly gentleman. All right? God doesn't speak to Eli. God speaks to Samuel as a child.
Yeah.
And again, I wish I could get into all the details, but maybe we'll preach on this particular thing later. But we see, and what God tells Samuel to do is to pronounce judgment on Eli. Now, you put yourself in little Samuel's shoes, okay? You're a child, and the man who's been raising you, who you look up to as a father figure or a grandfather figure, someone who you love and you respect, God says, I want you to pronounce my judgment on him. And it's a harsh judgment. Your whole family line will be cut off. And no longer to serve as priests, no longer to be continued. And that's a hard thing to do. But nevertheless, God calls Samuel, and it's evident to the people that Samuel speaks to God and God speaks to Samuel. It's very evident with the people that he has been chosen of God to be this judge, this messenger for God. Shortly thereafter, we see there's a war with the Philistines. The Philistines are a recurring enemy of God's people. The Philistines, they capture the Ark of the Covenant. This should tell you just how low Israel had gotten. Israel treated God like he was a rabbit's foot.
Yeah, sure.
Like he was just some good luck charm.
Yeah.
And let's just take the Ark of the Covenant into battle, because then we will win. And it wasn't because God will fight for us. And it wasn't because God is our shield and our buckler. It was because it's this magical token, the Ark of the Covenant. And God, in his providence, allows the Ark of the Covenant to be captured. Okay, you're going to treat God so flippantly. Let's see how you do without the presence of God. And we see the death of Hophni and Phinehas and Eli. Eli dies because he hears the news of the capture of the Ark of the Covenant, and he falls backwards on his chair and breaks his neck. All right, that is a pretty unusual way to go, but again, not an accident. This is something that God orchestrated. This is the judgment on Eli, Hophni, and Phinehas for their wickedness. The Philistines have the Ark of the Covenant, and it kind of goes back to one of those things, you know, be careful what you wish for. Because once you have it, you may discover you didn't really want it in the first place. The people are afflicted with plagues. There's this whole story. I love this part. They bring the Ark of the Covenant into the temple of their god, Dagon. And Dagon is standing there, a statue of Dagon, that is, and the Ark of the Covenant is before him. And the next day, he's fallen over. Okay, it's interesting to see these false gods even bow to the presence of God. Because there is none like God. And so they sit Dagon back up, and the next day he falls down again. And this time his hands and his head are completely taken off because he fell on the ground. And the Philistines realize, we can't keep this thing. This thing, we've got to send it away. And so they do. They send it back to Israel on a cart. They're not going to touch it. They're just going to just wave as it goes by. And it gets back to Israel. And again, Israel is pretty scared at this whole thing because of all the events that just happened. So the Ark of the Covenant just kind of sits by. So then we see Israel demands a king. And they reject God. Understand, I want you to, you are Israel, and your nation is relatively young, and you are the newcomers into Canaan, and there are people living all around you, and they have all of their gods. They have many different gods that they worship, and so you could understand, this is peer pressure. You could see why a lot of people would want to turn to other gods, because the people around them are turning to other gods. They also are led by a human king. When they go out to battle, there's the king dressed in his royal apparel, and he's got his sword, and he's leading his men into battle. And Israel doesn't have that. Israel has God. Now, understand, God is so much better than any human king.
Right.
But nevertheless, the people of Israel look around and they say, why can't we be like one of them? This is the dangers of the people you associate yourself with. Do you know what the number one most feared fish in the ocean is? I'll tell you, the number one most feared fish in the ocean does not have sharp teeth. It is not very big. It's only about this big. It has no poison that can act as a defense mechanism. It is actually a very slow swimmer, very weak swimmer. Its eyesight is not all that very good, but yet it is the most feared fish in the ocean. Why? Because the fish I'm talking about is called a remora. Now, a remora is a fish about this big, and you've probably seen a remora before in your life, except it's always accompanied by a much larger fish, and that's a shark. You know those little sucker fish that attach themselves to the shark? That's a remora. So when other fish see the remora swimming by, they know a shark is not too far behind. And that is why the remora is one of the most feared fish in the ocean, because of who it's associated with. Understand, the people you associate yourself with, the people you call friends, are going to give you a reputation.
Right.
And it will either be a reputation for good or for bad. But you don't get to choose the reputation, but you do get to choose your friends. And so that's just the warning here. So Israel looks to all the people around them, and they want to have a king, and they complain to Samuel about this. And this is where we get that verse that we read at the beginning. God tells Samuel, they didn't reject you. They rejected me, and so I'm going to give them exactly what they want. I must hurry. because like I said, I am going to try to get through this book, but we're kind of off to a slow start. So you see this man, Saul. Saul, he is from the tribe of Benjamin. And Saul, the Bible describes him as head and shoulders above everyone else. And his father, his donkeys got out of their pen, and he tells Saul, I need you to go and find my lost donkeys. Because understand, that is a detriment in the ancient world. That is your source of income. That is your source of work on your farm, is these animals. So to lose them is a big deal. So Saul and his servant, they're sent to go find the donkeys, and they take a roundabout way to get there, and they just so happen to arrive at a town where Samuel is staying. Now, God told Samuel, I don't want you to worry about finding this guy. I'm going to bring him right to you. I am going to bring him right to you, and you'll just know who it is when he's there. And wouldn't you know it, Saul, in looking for his father's lost donkeys, just so happened to enter into that same town. And out of all the people he could have walked up to, he just so happened to walk up to Samuel. And that's when God tapped Samuel on the shoulder and said, that's the guy. That's him. He will be the next king. Later on, there's some things, like I said, can't get into all the details, but Saul does get anointed to be king. Saul gets, there's a coronation for Saul, and we see Saul is really reluctant for this sort of thing. He hides amongst the luggage. He doesn't want all the attention and all the eyes on him. He didn't ask to be the king. He didn't even know that Israel was going to have a king. And that, imagine, that's a very important role, to be the first of anything. And he was going to be the first king. So later on, we see Saul gets victory over the Ammonites. And Samuel has to remind the people, it's tempting to look at your king and say it's because of him. And he got the victory. God gives the victory.
Right.
It's not your king, it is God. But do the people listen? No, they don't. And so we see Saul kind of gets too big for his britches,
yeah,
so to speak. He went from being humble and having just this meek spirit to being lifted up in pride because of his position and his power. So the next thing that happens is Saul disobeys God by wrongly making a sacrifice. He's about to go into battle, waiting for Samuel to show up, and Samuel doesn't show up, and he says, well, I could just do this myself. And so he offers a sacrifice, and Samuel comes up to Saul and says, what have you done? And Saul starts making excuses. That's what happens. When people do wrong, they naturally start making excuses. And this is actually a common thing for Saul. Nothing is ever Saul's fault. Saul always has to say, well, it's because of my circumstances. I had to do what I had to do because of circumstances. God is not ever going to put you in a position in some sort of circumstances where you have to do wrong.
Yeah.
Understand? So Saul disobeys God, and God rejects Saul. God rejects Saul for his disobedience. You could think of it like this. Saul rejected God, and so God rejects Saul.
Right.
It's not anything that it was not an unfair thing. So then we see Jonathan and his servant, they have this brave plan. Me and Brother Gentry were actually talking about this. And I wish I had the time to go into this, but understand, in our minds, this plan wouldn't make a whole lot of sense. Just to jump out in front of the enemy and say, here we are, and then go from there. It's a brave plan, and there's a huge victory, again, from the Lord, I believe. While he is away, Saul makes a foolish decision, does not consult the Lord. This is just in his human wisdom. Understand, we might think something is a great idea, and we've got our own wisdom, but that's not the same as God's wisdom.
Right.
He orders his men not to eat anything for the time being, and this leads to several problems. Number one, his men were too tired to fight. Number two, the men ate tainted food and got really sick because of it. And then number three, Saul almost killed his own son because Jonathan wasn't there to hear this order. So he starts eating, and Saul is willing to make an example of his own son for this foolish vow that he made. Always think through the thing. This is when we remember when we were in the book of Judges. We talked about Jephthah. You need to think through the consequences and what everything means before you start making vows like that. Saul disobeys God again by keeping plunder for himself, keeping livestock for himself, keeps the king of the enemy alive, which, by the way, comes back to bite Israel because that king was allowed to live. His line carried on. And eventually, we get to a man named Haman. And Haman is the enemy in the book of Esther. You know, we talked about that a couple weeks ago, how Haman essentially ordered that all Jews would be exterminated. Again, none of that would have ever happened if Saul would have just listened to God. But again, he was not listening to God. It was, I know what's best. I know what God says, but I think this is acceptable. And that's a bad mindset to have. So God rejects Saul, and David is anointed to be the king of Israel. Samuel is sent to Jesse, who is the son of Obed, who is the son of Ruth. So remember when we talked about the book of Ruth last week? So this should kind of give you some context. So Jesse has all these sons. They all pass before Samuel, and God hasn't chosen any of them to be the king except for the youngest, and that's David. And David's just the youngest. He's no one important. He's a shepherd. You understand? You don't give the person the title of shepherd. You don't have to have a whole lot of talent to be a shepherd. It's kind of the lowest of the low kind of jobs you can have is to watch sheep. But nevertheless, this is a great training opportunity for David because pretty soon he is going to be leading not his father's flock, but his heavenly father's flock. He's going to be leading the flock of Israel. You know, it's interesting. That's a principle about leadership. A leadership ought to be a servant. A leader ought to be the servant of all. Actually, I like how some countries, they call their leaders the prime minister because he is the first minister, the first servant of the people. And so David, we see this, that he's properly developed to be the king. He's had this experience leading sheep. We see the same thing with Moses. Back in Exodus, you remember he was a shepherd before he started leading people. We see the account with David and Goliath, and most people are associated with that story, David and Goliath. David goes into battle when no one else will. And when no one has any confidence in him, again, David realizes he's not going to win this battle. David knows if I go up against this giant, Goliath, the champion of the Philistines, on my own, I will die. I cannot beat Goliath, but God can. And so he goes into the battle with faith, and God delivers Goliath into his hand, and David is hailed a hero, and once again, David gives all the credit to the Lord. Now, this already burns up Saul, because Saul, he's very delicate. He's very delicate. He kind of feels threatened by his position. He already knows that God has rejected him from being the king. And so because of this, anybody that comes around and shows him up, he's going to feel threatened by. And so Saul is very jealous of David, and Saul actually tries to kill David on several occasions. And this is pretty funny because David finds a best friend in Jonathan, Saul's own son. Saul's own son, which, think about this for a moment. Who do you think was next in line to be king? Jonathan. And so for Jonathan to then be best friends with David, God's next anointed to be the king, this really burns up Saul. A lot of 1 Samuel, the end of 1 Samuel, is David running away from Saul. Lots of it. David ends up marrying Saul's daughter. And Saul says, well, you're not going to marry her that easily. You've got to kill 200 Philistines to do it. And wouldn't you know it, David does. And so I'm sure that burned up Saul even more. And so Saul is after David's life. David flees. And Jonathan actually saves David's life at one point. So Saul pursues after David, and David is on the run, and he goes to the temple and he asks for the holy bread that is only allowed for the priests. And so understand, the priests realize what David is, who he is going to be. And so they give him of the of that bread to eat. And Jesus actually references this very thing in the Gospels. The Pharisees were criticizing him, and Jesus was saying, do you understand that God is concerned with people's lives and not necessarily the strict set of rules that you have placed on things? God is more concerned with people's lives. And so David asks for the holy bread. David then proceeds to be insane. He proceeds to act like a crazy man. And then here's how crazy his he goes to live amongst the Philistines. Now, they have to think this man is crazy because he's knocking at their door wanting to live amongst them. The man that killed their superstar, their greatest fighter. But, I mean, we're talking about he pretends to be crazy. It talks about he's got spittle upon his beard and he's just raving. And so the Philistines realize maybe we could use this to our advantage. Maybe if we house him here, he will fight for us and he'll switch sides. And that doesn't go well for them. Saul finds out about this thing where the priest provided David an escape with the food. And so he crosses another line here. He has all of the priests executed. That is all up until this point, he has been rebelling against God, but he has crossed a line now. You have just killed all of God's priests. You don't come back from that. And so, again, we see with sin, it's a snowball. Just a little bit here and a little bit there. It always takes the next step. Yeah. And if it goes unchecked and unconfessed, it will only get out of control. Saul chases David some more. And David, and I'm going to kind of skip through some things here. David has the chance to kill Saul twice.
Yeah.
On two separate occasions. And both times, David leaves him alone and even tells him to his face, I am not going to touch God's anointed. And you would think that this would placate Saul, like, wow, David has so much character. But again, it only makes him more and more angry. We see later on, again, I kind of went through a couple things. Let's rewind it a little bit. David has this run-in with a guy named Nabal. And Nabal is essentially rude to him. He's looking for help as he's on the run. Nabal is rude to him, and his wife Abigail stays David and says it's all right. And she saves David and the men's lives, and eventually Nabal dies, and David ends up marrying Abigail. Then we see the death of King Saul. David lives amongst the Philistines. Saul consults with a medium, a witch, at Endor. Again, just taking another step in that rebellion. We see Saul consults a witch at Endor because God is not talking to him.
Yeah.
And so he says, well, if God's not talking to me, I'm going to talk to Samuel. I want you to bring up Samuel from the dead so I can speak to him. We see the Philistines, they distrust David, they kind of cast him out. David destroys the Amalekites, And then Saul and Jonathan die on the battlefield, committing suicide, really, falling on his sword, Saul did. And that is where we leave off in the book of 1 Samuel. Now, again, had to skip over a lot. I'm praying that this sort of Sunday school will encourage you to pick up and read. Read the book for yourself. There's so many more things in there. You ought to see what God has to say about rebellion. And this is what I referenced at the beginning. Rebellion is as the sin of witchcraft.
Right.
That is a phrase used in the book of 1 Samuel. Understand, don't ever do a whole lot of research on witchcraft. It's just not a door you want to open.
Yeah.
I've done a little bit of research into it. And again, I've done it. You don't have to. Witchcraft revolves around someone contacting a demonic spirit.
Right.
To do their bidding for them. Okay? That is what witchcraft is. Casting a spell is simply summoning a demonic entity, a demon. Do you understand when you rebel, when you are in rebellion against God, or you're in rebellion against God's leadership, or any of the authority in your lives, understand it's like witchcraft.
Yeah.
And I'd say it's so much worse, because in witchcraft, you're summoning a demon, but in rebellion, you are summoning the spirit of the devil himself.
Yeah.
Because isn't rebellion the thing that got him kicked out of heaven?
Yes, yeah.
And every time you rebel, it gives glory to the devil. It says, yeah, that's right. Fight the power. Fight the man. You are in control. You are a powerful human being. And that's a message for another time. I get really lost on that. But I want you to understand, God takes obedience and rebellion very seriously. And the difference in a wicked king and a terrible king who has a terrible legacy and Israel's greatest king is the willingness to just obey God. That's the difference.